In the absence of light, darkness prevails. There are things that go bump in the night, Agent Myers. Make no mistake about that. And we are the ones who bump back.
I think a character, the way that people normally talk about character in dramaturgy, it's almost an inherited form from the theater. And film has a way to not only create eye candy, but create what I call eye protein.
Yeah, high protein.
Which is actually nutritious and defines, you know, you can define a character with that.
From London in England, this is Simon.
From Toronto, Canada, this is the Mad Hatter.
And welcome to the Film Locker. This week, we're going to be looking at a director which I've had to do a lot of research for, because prior to this week, I'd only seen one film by him. What about you, Hatter?
When I took a look into his filmography, I was happy to note that I only had to see one film.
Oh, that's all right.
It worked out nicely for me, yeah.
This week, we are going to be talking about Guillermo del Toro.
Guillermo del Toro was born in Mexico, raised in a strict Catholic household. Del Toro described his Roman Catholic upbringing as excessively morbid, saying, "I'm mercifully lapsed as a Catholic, I say, but as Brunel used to say, I'm an atheist, thank God." Though insisting he's spiritually not with Brunel, and that once a Catholic, always a Catholic in a way, he followed by saying, "I believe in man. I believe in mankind as the worst and the best that has happened to this world." He first got involved in filmmaking when he was about 8 years old and studied special effects and makeup with special effects artist Dick Smith, who is known for his work on such films as The Godfather, The Exorcist, Taxi Driver and Scanners. Del Toro participated in the cult series The Horror Mercado with other renowned Mexican filmmakers such as Manuel Lubezki and Alfonso Cuarón. He spent 8 years as a special effects makeup designer and formed his own company, Necropia. In 1993, Del Toro got his first big break when Cronos won multiple awards in Mexico. He then went on to win the International Critics Prize at Cannes. Following this success, Del Toro, at the age of 33, was given $30 million by Miramax to make his first Hollywood film, Mimic. Next for Del Toro was The Devil's Backbone in 2001, a Spanish Civil War ghost story. The film was hailed by critics and audiences alike, and Del Toro decided to go back to Hollywood, and in 2002, he directed Blade 2, followed by Hellboy in 2004. Preferring to pull back a bit from Hollywood and craft another modestly budget dark fairy tale in the vein of The Devil's Backbone, Del Toro next focused his attentions on the production of Pan's Labyrinth. Pan's Labyrinth became a rare arthouse crossover hit and curried the favour of the Academy members, who showered it with Oscar nominations. In 2006, Universal announced that they had acquired the rights after Sony withdrew funding from Revolution Studios and were looking to move forward with Hellboy 2. Director Del Toro would once again be teaming with writer Mingola, and the stars Ron Perlman and Selma Blair would chronicle the further adventures of everyone's favourite BPRD agent. He has also co-founded the Guadalajara International Film Festival, and he's even formed his own production company, the Tequila Gang. It is clear that Guillermo del Toro has a unique view on the world. His unique blend of fantasy and gothic imagery is unforgettable, a star that will inevitably keep del Toro at the top of his game for the foreseeable future. A little bit about Guillermo del Toro. When did you... Because you obviously know him a lot better than I do. When did you first come into contact with Guillermo del Toro?
My first experience with Guillermo del Toro was in 2002 when I went to see Blade 2. I didn't know who he was or that he had directed it. I was really just going to see it because I liked Blade. But my first real experience knowing who he was as a director and his work was... around Christmas, New Year's of 2006, when I finally got to see Pan's Labyrinth.
See, I was up much more on the whole Pan's Labyrinth side of things. Mark Kermode. Do you know Mark Kermode in Canada?
The name sounds familiar, but I don't know why.
He's a film critic for the newspaper The Guardian. He's on the BBC as well. But he went on in a huge way about Pan's Labyrinth. He was a best film of the year. I think he even has his like quotation on the front of the DVD cover because he completely obsessed about it at the time. And to the point, really, that he went on about it so much, it ultimately inspired me to watch it myself. And I bought it on DVD. And I watched it, and I absolutely adored it. There was just something so fantastical about it, and so at the same time so unique about his filmmaking. It was only then I kind of realised, oh, that this is the same guy behind Hellboy and Blade 2. I have only recently seen Hellboy, and obviously Blade 2, I had no interest in that Blade series at all. You said, did you like the whole concept then, I guess, or the whole Blade?
Yeah, I liked the concept, and part two really builds on part one. Part two, it's not really a great movie. None of them are great movies at all. Like, he's very, very much a hired gun. It's really kind of like what we saw with Ang Lee in The Hulk, where Hollywood sees a foreign filmmaker and wants to give them a domestic property. So he was brought in to do that. He also did Mimic, but he disavowed Mimic. He actually wants to pretend that it doesn't exist, and I'm just fine with that.
But, I mean, that's interesting, because Mimic obviously was originally going to be only a 30-minute film alongside Danny Boyle's Alien Love Triangle.
That's right.
And Imposter. So it's quite weird that, you know, we've kind of gone back to another director. We've kind of mentioned, we've already looked at. So it's interesting how, you know, they've kind of been cut from the same cloth in some respects. But obviously, I think, you know, you couldn't find two completely different directors in Guillermo del Toro and Danny Boyle.
And of course. The other cool thing about del Toro, of course, is that he's really an inclusive filmmaker. There's the three Mexican filmmakers right now, Guillermo del Toro, Alfonso Cuarón, and José González Iñárritu, and they all work together. They're kind of like what we've read about in the 70s with Scorsese and Spielberg and Coppola, and how they were, and George Lucas, how they were all working on each other's projects and editing for each other and writing for each other. That's what these guys have together now. So Cuarón, for instance, he produced Pan's Labyrinth, or you'll see del Toro will do some editing for one of the others. And it's a really, really great spirit of camaraderie that I think it really, really goes hand in hand with his own filmography.
Well, that should lead, anyway, quite nicely into, obviously, with the background we've gave. I think we're going to plow ahead anyway with our film of choice, because we can get into a lot more detail on them. And obviously, do you want to reveal which one it is, Hatta?
Well, of course, we are going to do El Laberinto del Fauno. Cuéntame.
Okay, so that was a little bit of Pan's Labyrinth. Now, one thing which is interesting about Pan's Labyrinth is it's set in 1944 on a military outpost, but it's commanded by the quote-unquote evil stepfather of our lead character, who's a girl called Ophelia. And she's a young girl, about 13 or 14, who believes in fairy tales, and she reads fairy tales, and bit by bit as the film progresses, she falls into her own fairy tale. I think, would you think that's the best way to describe the story there, Hatta?
Yeah, I'd say that's definitely the best way to describe this film. It almost feels as though she's escaping from her own real horrors by kind of retreating into a fantasy world. This film does a much better job of what a modern film like Sucker Punch tried to do, where it said, if something evil is happening or something bad is happening around you, retreat in upon yourself and just count to 10 and you'll be okay. But this film does it in a way that is still very empowering to Ophelia. She's very much in control of this fantasy realm that she goes to, as opposed to a film like Sucker Punch where it's just girls and guns and whatnot.
I mean, the same thing is with del Toro mentioned, that the whole idea of, dreams and lucid dreaming is something which is rooted in this film, that he personally claimed that he actually, you know, went through this experience himself as a child, that he would see a fawn who would step out from behind a clock or something. And he would, you know, that's where he got this idea from. He used a lot of his stuff from The Devil's Backbone. I haven't seen that, but you have, haven't you, Hatta?
I have, and it carries with it the theme of the child as the protagonist and the empowered child, the one who's going to take up action and try and take control of a bad situation. The difference is that in The Devil's Backbone, it doesn't have this kind of fantastical element to it. It's more supernatural. Like that one deals with ghosts. This one, of course, deals with things like fairies and minotaurs and fauns and that kind of thing. So there's a common link. They'd actually make for a really, really nice double feature. But of course, they're very distinct from one another.
I'm really interested to watch that film. I mean, we'll get to obviously his back catalog in a moment. But I mean, I think a lot of that type of that fantasy element, the stuff which we see in Hellboy, especially more with Hellboy 2, that fantasy element, you really do see in Pan's Labyrinth some really fascinating creatures, and that goes into some incredible special effects and some incredible... The look of it is rooted in this kind of gothic culture. And at the same time, I think when you think about how he was nearly going to be directing those Hobbit films, I mean, something like Pan's Labyrinth really gives an idea about what type of creatures and what type of world maybe he would have created. But, I mean, as I understand, some of those sketches and some of that pre-production stuff might still be used.
The one thing that's actually really, really encouraging about this movie is... here's my experience with this story. This is one of the films I always talk about. We're coming up on the Toronto International Film Festival, and this is actually pretty well-timed that this episode is coming now. Because I always say that for every film festival, and you probably went through this at the London Film Festival as well, you can't see everything, and inevitably something really good gets past you. And in 2006, this was the movie. Lady Hatter actually wanted to see this, and I just said, no, I want to see this other thing instead. And all I heard about all festival long was Pan's Labyrinth, Pan's Labyrinth, Pan's Labyrinth. And I missed it. So the other thing that I heard at the time, though, and this is more to my point, was that people didn't know how exactly it was going to play, because on the one hand, it was being described as a fairy tale for adults, and a lot of people who I talked to said, I don't know where the market is for that movie. So the fact that it was so well received, it cost about $20 million and it made four times that, is really, really, it's such a great thing for this film to have achieved.
No, I completely agree. And more importantly, I mean, it's set within, the post kind of Civil War of Spain in 1944. And with that in mind, you kind of think, again, this could not be made by any other kind of a director who understands the Spanish culture.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing. I mean, having it rooted, it's in the Spanish language. It's got all these kind of associations with Spanish culture. And obviously, more importantly, the history of Spain. And you kind of think, you know, if they were speaking in American accents, if it was set in a different place, it just wouldn't have the same thing. And this is what I go on about when we talk about Pedro Almodovar, and when we talk about, I mean, if I was to talk about Amelie, I mean, these are films which are rooted in their culture, and this is where, you know, you're missing out if you're not keen on watching films without subtitles, because there are films there which you just will not get in the English language. You will miss out on. And this film has so much kind of, so many elements which you just can't see anywhere else. I mean, in a certain sense, in terms of the visual kind of style of Guillermo del Toro, you won't see that anywhere else. But more importantly, the kind of the world which you're actually seeing, which kind of Ophelia effectively creates.
I have a question for you. Is this film too violent?
I think yes and no. I mean, I'll tell you one thing. When I watched it, I got to a point about halfway through, and I said, you know what this is about? This is about the young girl, the woman, or a girl becoming a woman, as it were.
That's quite profound.
And the more I watched it, the more, I mean, the thing is that fairy tales are often about that. When you think about Alice in Wonderland, the idea, because she's obviously a very, you know, at that time, that kind of puberty time of her life, and she's changing in that regard, and it often comes up a lot in fairy tale stories. I'm sure there's many more, and this is no different. And as you watched it, there are lots of kind of sides to which is revealing that kind of the use of blood, the use of red, you know what I mean, constantly as a recurring theme. And that again links in with that theme of puberty and of femininity, and that's something which I think comes through again and again. So I think on the one hand you say about how it being so violent in some respects, and obviously in some cases quite grotesque, I think that's the idea about if this was a complete loss of innocence. And obviously, you know, if you have a fairy tale where you show the loss of innocence, there's only so much non-innocent stuff you can show, as it were. And so I think this is a film where because it's going all out, as it were, it actually has an opportunity to be quite graphic and be quite grotesque and horrific. I mean, that the creature with the eyes on the hands is just horrific. It's horrible. I mean, again, going back to that idea about what maybe a girl's perception of this kind of creature, is it the idea that someone who can't see things or who sees things in the wrong way sees things with their hands, you know what I mean? And that's really quite a creepy thing when you put it in context of that kind of young woman who's coming out into the world and seeing all these different people.
So you're okay. So that's what I'm saying. So you think a guy whose face gets smashed in with a bottle, a fairy getting its head bitten off, a guy whose face gets sliced with a razor, it's all okay within context.
Yeah, because I think, like I said, we talk about the loss of innocence. The loss of innocence isn't just falling down a rabbit hole and seeing a bunny running around with a clock. You know what I mean? That's not really it. Or just seeing any... I mean, even with Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland, I haven't seen that. But what I do understand is that it is quite gothic and quite grim. There's one sequence, I think, in it where she does walk over all these kind of rotten corpses and bodies. Am I right? You've seen it, yeah?
Yeah. She walks over. There's a moat full of the heads that have been lopped off.
Yeah, and that in itself is quite a grotesque thing. But I think in the same way, this is kind of pushing it even further. I mean, Guillermo del Toro is not appealing to kids here. He's appealing, like you said, to adults.
So in a way, really, it actually gets back to the classic fairy tales, because in the original Cinderella, for instance, when the stepsisters can't get their feet into the glass slipper, they cut them off to try. They cut their feet to actually try and get it to fit in.
In the actual fairy tale itself.
Yeah. So this is kind of what you're saying is this is actually kind of going back towards that sort of classic bloody subtextual fairy tale.
Yeah. No. Oh, definitely. Definitely. I think so. Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
Well, there we go.
But I mean, and then going back to try and keep these podcasts in line with what we've done so far, I mean, some of those kind of graphic bursts of violence, which you see through it as well, that's something which I think reminds me of that sequence in, say, remember in A History of Violence, mm-hmm. when it first shows these two guys getting attacked by the character, and then it just suddenly cuts to this disgusting face on the floor, just blood pouring out.
Right.
And I think in a similar way, you've got this here when you see the kind of the bottle on the farmer's nose, and when you see Mercedes kind of stabbing her stepfather. Those type of things are really these sudden bursts of violence, and it kind of just jolts you out of this kind of, ooh, I'm watching a dream, you know what I mean? And it kind of makes it very much more real. And that's what I think is, again, which is quite fascinating about, because that's the thing about fairy tales, isn't it? Is that you want them to have this connection to reality, but obviously the whole point of a fairy tale is that it's not.
Very cool. Any other thoughts on Pan's Labyrinth?
Not really. Like I said, I think when you get that whole idea about the importance of the feminine kind of angle to the film, I think everything starts to take a different meaning. I mean, even when you just see things like the trees and the kind of shapes of the trees, you know what I mean? And the fact that the fact that adults don't see these fairies and yet the kids kind of do, and all these different things. When you watch it and you have that in the forefront of your mind, because like I said, it came to me about halfway through, everything seems so much more clearer. And I think that's probably that's an important part of the story.
Well, I'll be honest, you're making me want to go back and watch it again, because I had not thought of that, and now that I have that in mind, I'd love to see it again with that in the forefront of my brain.
Well, you're going to watch it, you'll be like, oh, maybe not.
Well, that's, you know, you know me, I watch 10 movies a week, so I'm sure I can fit this.
And then just squeeze it in.
There
easy.
You go.
Okay, well, I think that's all we're going to have for our Pan's Labyrinth discussion, but we're going to be able to go back and discuss more about his back catalogue, namely the films which I've seen in the last week, so that'll be great, just after this. Was a bit of a discussion on Pan's Labyrinth, but obviously Guillermo del Toro has been making films from way back in 1993, and one of his big films which he made in Hollywood especially was Mimic in 1997. I haven't managed to see that. What about yourself, Hatter? You have, though.
Long time ago. The one thing I remember about Mimic, and I don't really know if I can pin this on Del Toro or not, is that it was really, really dark. Like, my nightmare would be watching Mimic in a theater now where the projector is turned down for 3D, because you would not be able to see a damn thing.
Well, then we've got, what is it, Devil's Backbone, which, I mean, you mentioned briefly when we were discussing Pan's Labyrinth and its connections to Pan's Labyrinth.
It's a ghost story. Del Toro actually produced recently a film called El Orfanato, or The Orphanage.
Oh, yeah, no, I heard a lot about that. Again, that was, you know, hugely touted in a big way by this Mark Kermode fella. Huge fan, I think he is.
Yeah, that has elements of Devil's Backbone, mostly in the orphanage structure, because Devil's Backbone is set in an orphanage, and there's the ghosts again. So the main crux of the Devil's Backbone is, you know, that there's always this ghost of a child who is harmed in some way at this orphanage, and he's always present. Now, the cool thing about this orphanage, the one thing that I just can never, ever get around, the beautiful look of it, is it's got this open courtyard. In the middle of it, it's got this like open desert courtyard, and in the middle of the courtyard, a bomb, like a World War II era drop bomb, has lodged itself into the ground, and it's just this beautiful visual of this open courtyard surrounded by these buildings and a bomb wedged into the ground. And the children are always joking about, is it actually active? Is it not active? If you lean against it, you can hear it ticking. And it's, you know, it's this beautiful little metaphor for the danger that always seems to be present at this orphanage. And the interesting thing about this film is that it was kind of a co-production with Del Toro and one of our previous Film Locker subjects, Pedro Almodovar.
Oh, no, it's nice. How strange.
Yeah. So the fantastical element is down a little bit considering his other films, but the creep factor and the suspense factor is exactly at what you would expect for Guillermo del Toro.
But it's interesting to go from the Devil's Backbone. I mean, you mentioned there was this kind of background to it with regards to, you know, the World War II. And obviously Kronos begins with that kind of World War II or element whereby, oh, we found this a few years ago, even further back to the 16th century, but it touches upon the war time there. And then obviously Hellboy starts off with that kind of opening within world, or the end of World War II, and the idea that it's kind of, I think there's something which really interests him, which is that pure evil, and about how this real evil side of you know, fantasy perhaps, but evil kind of coming in contact with people who are to some extent pure, or people who are good. I mean, out of evil obviously emerges Hellboy.
Yeah.
In such a horrific event, that's where he is born from. And it is the goodness of this guy, is it Broom, I think it is, or Groom, I think the guy was, who looked at him, who brought him up. And that's fascinating to see, because I think in the same way with Kronos, who attacks is somebody who appeals to be very, very good at heart. And that's the fascinating side of things.
Yeah, it kind of gets back to, again, his production work on Orphanage of not being afraid by appearances. You know, we even go back to Pan's Labyrinth, and even though Ophelia should be absolutely freaked out by a lot of what she's seeing, she has to learn to see past these things and accept them for something that's deeper, that's there. And certainly that's in play in Hellboy as well.
Yes, they're very, very true. I mean, and that's one thing which I think is great about Hellboy, is that you can see a lot of his, though it's obviously very much Hollywood, very much something which they want to make a lot of money, I think at the same time it's something which he has managed to get in a lot of his own personal kind of things. I don't know what way to put it, but you can see a lot of that in it, in that you do have that use of nature and that organic side of things. I mean, it's almost like, I think I was thinking about how it's almost like Tim Burton is kind of combined with David Cronenberg's kind of grotesqueness.
That sounds about right.
Really, the whole really graphic side of things, you see a lot in Guillermo del Toro's work, but it's rooted in this gothic kind of fairy tale world. And Hellboy, you know, has got that element. Hellboy, I mean, is rated a 12 in England, and it's horrendous. I mean, I run a film club, and I was thinking, oh, this might be a good one to show the kids, because it's a 12. And actually, watching it, I'm thinking, actually, it won't. I mean, you've got sequences where you have that character with those knives, you know, shackled to his arms, and he's just, you know, stabbing people repeatedly. I mean, that's
the guy drains his blood into the labyrinth.
Oh, God, of course. You know? Yeah, I mean, this is really horrific stuff. And it links really nicely, like I said, with the type of thing Tim Burton would do. Think about Sleepy Hollow. You have that kind of idea of blood and trees all, like, working together, all that type of thing. And yet, with Guillermo del Toro, he pulls it up a notch. So it's much more graphic, much more, you know, dare I say, obscene kind of side of things.
Well, all his violence has an elegance to it, right? He's not looking to shock. He is looking to grab your attention, but he's looking to do it in a very, very lyrical way.
Yeah, no, definitely. Okay, I think it's probably a good moment to go to the top shelf of the locker. What about yours, Hatter, first off?
Well, for me, this was the new Del Toro watch for me this week, and that's Kronos. This film came out in 1993. It's his earliest film by a long shot. This movie actually showed me that, while I haven't actually looked into it, so I can't completely prove it, he must be a fan of David Cronenberg, because there's a lot of Cronenberg going on in this movie. Everything from... everything from the bugs to the gadgetry to the way the gadgetry interacts with biology of the human body. And it is a fantastic movie. Criterion has just put it out on DVD about this antique shop owner who finds a little device in one of his antiques. And it turns out the device was conceived many, many years ago, many, many centuries ago, as a way to... offer everlasting life. So he's got it. It's got the children around it again. He's got his granddaughter who's always around him and who worries about him and who helps him at his shop. We've got an evil presence that wants to get their hands on this device. They have been looking for it for much, much longer than he has. The goon is Ron Perlman, Hellboy himself. And it is just a fabulous movie. I love Del Toro's attention to mechanics. This will come up in the movie that you're going to talk about, but if you look at movies like Pan's Labyrinth and like Kronos, you always see this fascination with gears and sprockets and, you know, a mechanical world. And it's really, really cool, and it plays heavily into Kronos.
And at the same time, this brings in a side of it, which is also that Catholicism, which is part of him, and something which he brings up a lot of times. And you often see the kind of imagery of these almost kind of Virgin Mary kind of statues and that kind of Gothic imagery and churches and architecture in that regard. And obviously the Kronos bug is found inside one of these. But at the same time, I think you've got in this the lead character, his name is Jesus.
Yeah.
He's a character who is resurrected. There's discussion on the fact that the idea of resurrection is not something that God would be against, in that ants and spiders, they will hide in rocks for hundreds and hundreds of years and then suddenly emerge again and be resurrected, as it were. And yet, at the same time, this character, who's obviously effectively got quite a good heart to some extent, at the same time, he's got these similarities with Dracula, in that he's this kind of need for blood. There's this element that he hates sunlight, that he kind of, towards the end, he's in a coffin. And it's fascinating to see this idea, this kind of conflict, I think, of religion, where you have this idea of these people you believe in and these, you know, processes you even take part in that transubstantiation of, you know, taking the body of Christ, and Catholics taking the body of Christ on a weekly basis. I mean, is that not the same thing as this guy who craves this blood on a regular basis to gain eternal life? It's fascinating, I think, especially in Kronos, to see these themes coming through that much more clearly.
It's his own story, so it's cobbled together through a lot of his own Catholic superstitions and Catholic beliefs and upbringing. It's a really wonderful, just on the base level, a really wonderful story that he's executed very, very well.
And there's that innocence as well. I mean, that little girl, you see that again in Kronos, you see it in Pan's Labyrinth, the innocence of the girl who's not afraid of the dead.
It sort of protects the viewer from descending too far in the darkness if you give it to us through a child.
Yes.
And it seems like that's almost always what he's doing.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, yeah.
Or very often what he's doing, anyway. What about you? What's your choice off the top shelf?
I'm going to go with Hellboy 2, The Golden Army. Now, there's a lot of problems with this film, but I think at the same time it's got some really interesting points to it. I mean, you still have that Gothic look. You've got that fascinating idea of nature and about the beauty of nature and the destructiveness of nature. And so that's really interesting, because, again, when you think about that Gothic element, Gothic you know, buildings and arches, whereby they have those trees and nature intertwined with it. You know, it's beautiful, but it's also quite destructive. I think that's a lot where that whole style comes from. But at the same time, you know, you've got that, and then you've also got at odds with that, like you said before, the cogs and all that mechanical working, which is not only, it's in the opening credits, but it's a huge part of it, in that the Golden Army itself is made by all these cogs which are interlocking and, you know, all that side to it. I really enjoyed it. Did you enjoy it at all?
I loved it, actually. I saw this one back in the theater when it first came out in the summer of 2008. This was, I think, just a week or two before The Dark Knight. It was a month or so after Iron Man, so it was a really, really great summer for comic book films.
Yeah.
And I loved that, again, we have Hellboy having to decide whether he's on the right side of a fight, because, you know, he's got all of these mythological creatures and supernatural creatures saying, why are you fighting for humanity? They'll turn on you.
I mean, for me, I mean, one of my problems with the film would be that the specific story. I was a bit like, yeah, I was kind of like, it's like X-Men / the Men in Black, you know what I mean? That they're government agents. And, you know, you even had that kind of comedic, oh, we're walking past the hallway with all these creatures, you know, going crazy in the background. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I like the identity theme. But I think too often, especially with comic book films, you have got that whole, am I accepted as a society and people don't accept me, and therefore, shall I be a part of them or should I go against them? And I felt like with Hellboy 1, there was a whole point about him being this kind of, he was almost a stray, in that he kind of was picked up and he found this connection with these cats. And then you had the girl who was, you know, she was in this mental asylum, but she ultimately stood by that. And you had this really nice conflict there. But I thought in Hellboy 2, it was like, it just went down the roots of this very, like I said, X-Men storyline, which ultimately I prefer X-Men in terms of that story. Yeah. But in terms of how it looks, I prefer Hellboy 2.
That was the other thing, is that the look of this film is absolutely fantastic. I hope that he hangs on to this effects team, because the look of this film is amazing, and it really, really made me anxious to see what he was going to be able to do with The Hobbit. Now, obviously, The Hobbit is not going to happen through Del Toro, but it's unfortunate because it looked like that was what he was setting himself up for. A lot of the work with, you know, you get those throne rooms where the leaves are still falling, or you get those long shots over just the battalions and battalions of the Golden Army, and I could just see how that could have come into play with The Hobbit. I loved the look of this, and it was a film that I really, really dearly appreciated, and I think it's been a little too long since I've seen it. I kind of wonder how long it's going to take to get around to a Hellboy 3.
Okay, time for some trivia after this. Okay, so we've got into the roots of Guillermo del Toro, mind the pun there. and now it's time for some trivia. How are you? Are you ready for your trivia, Hatter?
I'm ready and willing. Do remember that you can email your answers in and try and win a Blu-ray or DVD of your choice. And send your answers to filmlocker@hotmail.com and see if you know the answer to these Guillermo del Toro questions. My first question goes like so. Name the crime drama already discussed in the film Locker that Guillermo del Toro turned down the chance to direct. Question number two, what is the name of the creature Ophelia places below her mother's bed to keep her safe in Pan's Labyrinth? And my final question, which classic film caused Guillermo del Toro to become a vegetarian for a span of 4 years?
The Hobbit.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, my three questions. What film did Guillermo del Toro not produce from the following three? Beautiful, Splice, or Amores Perros? Okay, so it's which one of those three did he not produce? So two of them he has produced. Which actor has appeared in both Kronos, Hellboy, and Hellboy 2? And finally, which animated TV show creator provided the voice for a character in Hellboy 2, The Golden Army? And I think at this stage, because we're like in the 11th episode, and there's people, obviously, if you enter this week in the competition, I think I know what I'll try and do. I'll try and send you an email back to say thank you. That's the prize this week. Because I think
that's the gift that keeps on giving.
Oh, of course. You can keep it. You can frame it. Put it on your wall. Put them on a mini.
Well, if you want to read more of Simon's writing, you can do so at screeninsight.blogspot.com.
And if you want to read more of Hadda's work, go to mcneilmatinee.blogspot.com.
Of course, there's always more Del Toro content to be had at the blog for the Film Locker. That's filmlocker.blogspot.com.
So, the last one next week, Hatta, are you ready?
I'm ready. I'm a little bit sad that we're at the end already, but hopefully we'll be able to go out with a bang with number 12.
Okay, see you next week, folks.
Bye. When you're